This podcast was made possible by an anonymous Irvingtonian and by our primary sponsor, Artisan Realtors, your Irvington real estate source.
Welcome to another edition of Firehouse Irvington, where we have always said that it is the small connections that make the big picture. The reason we selected Irvington is, of course, because it is absolutely unique in its position inside of a big city. It's an island, and we've said many times it's almost more of a peace of mind than an exact geographical location. Today, we have a very special edition of Firehouse Irvington. And we have a guest on before. We've talked both on and off the air about what happens with history nerds. They have their own internal nuclear history reactor. And today I thought I'm going to get two history nerds to join me. I'm the amateur history nerd, but you guys are the pros. And sitting immediately to my right is Glory. And if I get this wrong, I am so sorry.
I will beat you.
Glory June Greif.
Yes.
There you go. And Glory has a great background, not only in broadcasting, but history and specifics about today's topic. And then sitting immediately next to Glory is the chairman emeritus of History Nerds, the great Alan Hunter. And Alan, I know you just got busy immersing yourself in Mark Twain history. We're going to switch gears just a little bit on you, but I'm going to guess your trip was absolutely remarkable, as many of your trips are.
Anybody that has the opportunity needs to go to Hannibal, Missouri. I think it's the most fitting thing that you can say is they're an hour behind us, and it's literally like going back in time.
So it is everything. Wonderful. As you said, the epicenter of Mark Twain.
That's right.
And you feel that when you're there.
And it's socially acceptable for me to smoke as many cigars as I care to.
Ah, I like that. Now, we are doing this podcast inches away from US 40 or in Indianapolis. We know it is Washington Street. Mm-hmm. But this is literally the National Road.
The National Road.
And anybody that grew up in central Indiana had a parent or grandparent go, well, that's the National Road. Now, the National Road has an absolutely amazing story behind it.
Oh,
and I know both of you guys have so many interesting stories about this. Alan, you've actually written a couple of books. And from what I've gathered, there's a couple of more books on the way specifically about the National Road.
Yeah, I was a former officer of the Indiana National Road Association, was a board member for a long time, still have friends in that organization. We will be doing things on, we will have our annual meeting here in Irvington. We just ironed out the details. I'll be speaking at that. That's going to be in October, just like everything in Irvington's in October. I believe it's Wednesday, October 16th. Is that right, Rhonda? Probably about 7 o'clock at night, but you'll be able to go into Lodge 666 and learn about the National Road.
That's another quirky thing about Irvington.
Yes.
Gloria, I didn't know if you knew this, but we have the 666 Lodge
indeed,
inches away from here as well.
Yes.
It's good mojo, though, we've found.
Yeah.
I,
too, used to be on the National Road Association
board.
Cool. So I think we did not.
I thought I saw the bruises on you.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
Now, Gloria, you'd made the comment moments before we came on the air. One of the ideas and concepts behind this was, let's link the state capitals together.
Yeah, well, that seemed to be the obvious place to make the links happen, certainly. The idea was to get from the national capital of Washington, D.C., up the canal to Cumberland, Maryland, and then westward into this brand new territory.
And the thing I like the best is to put these things in perspective, and Alan, that's one thing I enjoy, what you talk about is, you know, we'll read a paragraph of, okay, this happened, but there's context around it. And America wasn't really going to be in the automobile until about 1910 consistently, when Henry Ford started to really build a lot of Model Ts and bring the prices down. In fact, I just got through doing a research project for a client. 1908 was, that's when he started, but I'm just saying from 1910 on is kind of what I was getting at, is that, you know, he didn't really get the production up. By about, I would say by, in my opinion, and you guys are historians too, I'd say probably by about 1915 did America start to...
The war kind of interrupted the flow of this.
Did they start to really think, well, you know, maybe I could own a car. But anyway, mm-hmm. I was doing some research for another client. The motorcycle became very, very, very popular mm-hmm. at the turn of the century because people were familiar with the concept, hey, I can ride a bike, and here's a bike that'll go about 30 miles per hour. I'm all about it. But as Henry Ford's cars came down in price, the motorcycle kind of went away because people liked the convenience of the car. So in 1910, what kind of roads did we have to drive on?
Oh, they were really bad. Well, what we also should mention is it was the Good Roads Movement for that very purpose. And it started with bicycle riders in the late 19th century. There was a really strong effort to make good roads so bicycle riders could go out into the country because that was becoming open to everyone. Even women were right. riding bicycles. Oh my goodness. But then, as the cars came along, the whole concept of the Good Roads Movement was beginning to change, and they were focusing on farm-to-market roads. Can farmers actually have good roads to deliver their goods to the market towns?
So, about what era, Alan, did they really start to think we've got to have a national road?
Well, from the start. I mean, George Washington was the first one that came up right. with the idea. Thomas Jefferson was the one that signed the legislation, and people don't fully realize that the national road, Cumberland Pike, right. Was our first federally funded national highway. It had, of course, like everything in this country, its origins were as a Native American Indian trail. Mm-hmm. Washington used it as a surveyor, venturing just about every place he went, Pittsburgh and into the Ohio's West Virginia, surveying. And it was pretty much his idea in the back of his mind to have this happen. What people don't realize, I suppose, because it was so long ago, that at the time, you're talking, 1811 to about 1835.
Right.
There was a battle going on, not just for the roads, but canals. Mm-hmm. The railroad was just coming into vogue. So you literally had a battle between a couple entities to which is going to take over, because the roads had to go through forests. You had to cut down trees. You had to dig mm-hmm. up stumps. The waterways were already there, and their ideas
fact, yes,
was
to get up to Cumberland from Washington, yeah. you took a canal.
Yeah, and let's just dig it a little bit deeper and yeah. a little bit further, and we'll just use this natural road.
And I would say, too, as in the middle of the 1850s until, you know, the Civil War came along, and it was like now we're trying to move war materials around, it probably was mostly agrarian, et cetera, at that point. There wasn't this burning desire, hey, my family and I, we live in Washington, D.C., but we're going to vacation somewhere in Ohio. No one thought along those lines.
The concept of vacation is a pretty new thing, really, except for the very wealthy. So average families certainly weren't thinking in terms of vacation, and the people who could afford to ride, they'd find a way, you know. But so
it was more a move for opportunity.
But it was a movement for opportunity, exactly, yeah. I was about to say.
So you're going to make this national road. You're going to have to acquire the land. Did the government just do... where they just declared, hey, this is our land and this is what we're going to do?
For the most part, the land was there for the taking.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to do much because it was very unpopulated. It would have been wooded areas. That's why the canals were an attractive alternative, because all you had to do is stick a boat in there and you're on the road. And it's hard for us to imagine that nowadays, because you think, okay, we're moving down a river and we're serving at the whims of the waterway, but it was just an easier way to do it. In Indiana, if you start in Richmond and you start towards Indianapolis, the one thing that you will find is that the major towns along the roads are, if you were to transport yourself back to the Civil War era, they are laid out exactly one day's wagon ride
exactly.
from each other.
So
that's
towns.
About 10 miles, 8 to 10 miles. Mm-hmm. And you'll run into these still, these great big massive houses that served as inns
mm-hmm.
Where the travelers...
Some of them are museums.
Yeah. Yeah, Huddleston House is there, and this is where people stayed. And if you had enough money, you stayed inside in the cellar. If you didn't have any money, you slept on the porch.
And this does give a hint of how tough the travel was, because a day's travel in a wagon, as you said, 10 to 12 miles.
Well, a lot of times these were drawn by oxen. Oxen don't go very fast.
Yes. And on
they were
rough
carrying
roads.
All their worldly goods in a Conestoga wagon.
So about how long did it take the National Road to actually make it to Indianapolis or to Indiana?
That's hard to say. I mean, they were working on it in, what, 27, 28?
Yeah, and it was in fits and starts and bits and pieces when I wrote a transportation study for the state many years ago, and that's how I described it.
Were you able to pinpoint it? No, because
it was just that. We did a little here and a little there and went beyond. We acquired that land farther than we have come with the road, so we'll work on that next. So, and people on this podcast cannot see my hands moving around, but...
But the reason why I even bring this up, you know, National Road gets mentioned a lot if you grow up here in Indiana, and then it was... You know, pretty easy to say, okay, it was US 40. Indiana has the distinction of having relatively flat terrain. So, you know, building a road from Richmond to Terre Haute.
That's when you get to Putnam County.
Somewhat straightforward.
Or when you get to Dublin.
That's true. Yeah.
Dublin got its name because there's a hill in that town, one of the very few on the National Road, and the guys had to double up their mule teams to get over that, or their oxen to get over that hill.
Now, is Washington Street / US 40, is that still on the exact original route of the National Road?
Close.
Mostly.
There are places along the road that you can
especially
tell and visit.
Especially where there's bridges.
Yeah.
And was the idea to go circa Washington, D.C.-esque, the capital west, did it, like, begin in, as you said, fits and starts, but... Mm-hmm. Did we start building part of this in Missouri, part of it in Illinois, part of it in Ohio, and then link them together?
Yeah. Not in Missouri, because it didn't really quite reach there until...
Yeah, we fizzled out in Illinois.
So we got
to Springfield.
So it never got any farther than Springfield.
Yeah.
Was it Vandalia, Illinois?
Vandalia,
is that the terminus?
Actually. And Vandalia was the capital, you see. But after that, it was mainly a dotted line on a map. And it was supposed to get to St. Louis for obvious reasons, because that was a jumping off point for further west. But it never quite made it, although the towns between Vandalia and St. Louis will claim to be on the National Road.
Now, do we consider this somewhat of a failure if it only got to Illinois? Because it sounded like
that.
A great idea.
I wouldn't say it was a failure. It brought hundreds, thousands of families to Ohio and especially Indiana, and in some cases beyond Illinois, too.
Was the original scope, though, to... make it go all the way to the West Coast, or do we?
Oh, never the West Coast, because at that time we didn't even have the West Coast.
Yeah.
So that was much, much later.
That didn't happen until after World War I, and that was a movement that by then there were all kinds of roads that were trying to do it.
Yeah, the idea of federal highways really took hold. Well, it was beginning, again, before World War I, and suddenly the war interrupted everything.
Right.
And then it really took off as soon as World War I was over.
One of the things about early roads that fascinate me is the construction. We here in Indianapolis have always enjoyed that many of the main roads in this city were paved by brick. Mm-hmm. And presumably it was guys down on their hands and knees installing these bricks. Mm-hmm. There were very few automatic brick pavers. The ones that were in use in big cities. What was the original construction of the National Road?
Well, it would have been dirt. Rock, cordwood.
Yeah, that varied a lot, too. There were some areas it was barely cleared.
Yeah. Stumps.
Corduroy
stumps
road.
Stumps were used.
Stumps, yes.
That sounds like good. Well, it couldn't be any bumpier than some of today's
That's
roads.
That's right. I think the corduroy road would be smoother, actually.
And exactly. And even though there was money to build it, there really wasn't money to maintain it.
Right.
And that was one of the things that people complained about.
There were some sections of the National Road. There was a movement in the 1850s, and it was Robert Dale Owen, who was very much in
New
favor
Harmony.
Of it, for plank roads. And plank roads were considered a great idea because they were smooth, but Indiana's pretty swampy in a lot of places, and there were parts of the National Road that were planked. And, of course, the boards they used were too green, and they warped in no time, so that was a complete failure.
So the idea was you get a sawmill operation going, and you just mm-hmm. bring the planks out, and
then you
just lay them down in the road.
And then, you know, Indiana's well known, and Irvington's well known for bricks. You know, and Brazil bricks. They went to bricks, but bricks had a strange way of in Indiana weather they would dome up.
Yeah, the heat and cold.
Yeah, the cycle.
Clay County is well named, although it was not named for its mineral. That's where a lot of the clay is. So.
I love the fact that Alan is one of those guys that finds things. You'll go to sales and you'll bump into collectors somewhere, and you have the ability to find things, many times things that haven't been seen by others.
Well, I guess I'd be the carrot top of historians, because I find this stuff, I want to preserve it. I wouldn't say much of it's worthy, museum worthy, but it's savable. And if you don't grab it, literally it will disappear.
You sent, or you gave to me, this is a document dated April 15th, 1864.
Before you read it, here's the actual document, Jay, and you can hold it in your hands.
That is amazing. And was this state government?
That's 1864. This would have been.
We have to be careful. I'm going to drool on this. Oh my God!
This would have been. This would have been one of the copies of a lawsuit where this guy was running the road, not paying the tolls.
Oh man!
Good night.
And what I did was, if you read that, you'll see that coincidentally, it's from April 15th, 1864. A year later, everybody knows what happened there. Lincoln died.
Yes.
That pegs it right in the middle of the Civil War. And it's written in legalese that we all, when we see and hear, we cringe. But it outlines some of the purposes of the road, and it outlines some of the things you can do and you can't do, and it outlines the cost to use the road.
We'll include this on the website, but yes, I want to hand that back to you and be ultra careful. But that's so amazing that is an original copy of it.
It's a lot sturdier than you think. Paper was better back then than it is.
Yeah, this is live paper, which is interesting.
See, paper actually was, but the central
writing is readable, which is unusual for 19th century writing.
Oh, yeah.
The Central Plank Road Company, a corporation duly organized and existing under the laws of Indiana, is the owner of a plank and gravel road extending from Plainfield in Hendricks County along the old National Road through Indianapolis to Sugar Creek in Hancock County in the state of Indiana, and are authorized to erect and maintain toll houses and toll gates along said road at proper and convenient places, and had made, ordained, and established ordinances and bylaws to regulate the travel on said road, and prescribing the rules to be observed by persons meeting and passing with teams and vehicles, and to fix the rates of tolls. So I think it's kind of interesting that there were even tolls involved early on in the road, but I'm going to guess that was a maintenance scheme, correct?
I should say that was the system of road maintenance in this state, and actually pretty much in the country, for most of the 19th century. The whole idea was that groups could get together and charge tolls for a certain section if they maintained it. That was true on our Michigan Road as well. In fact, there was an extant toll house on Michigan Road where they did the same thing. It was the Augusta Gravel Road Company.
Do we still have some of the toll houses along US 40?
None in Indiana that I'm aware of.
But there are some really cool ones in Maryland and Pennsylvania.
Yeah, as you said, the one on Michigan Road is the second you see it, you realize, oh, that's got to be what it does. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was the idea. It was up to the private sector. You know, it's not a new concept. Up to the private sector to take care of the roads. And I have, talking about finding cool things, I have a map from about 1895 of this county. And there are all these gravel roads marked, like Bluff Road and, of course, the National Road. And they're marked Free Gravel Road. The idea being free, because that is when, in the early 1890s, the state decided they would take over the maintenance of these major arteries.
By that time, the state was exerting more influence over infrastructure.
And up until that, like you said, up until that time, you know, you built your toll house, you maintained the bridge, you maintained the road. There are a few of the original wooden signs. Mm-hmm. There's one at the Henry County Historic
I've seen that
museum.
One.
That's wonderful. And you think that the stuff that's in this document was on those signs.
It's so amazing. By the way, be it ordained by the Central Plank Road Company that the following rules shall be observed while traveling on said road or any bridge thereof. 1, no person shall either ride or drive over the bridge faster than a walk. So see, that was an early speed trap, Alan. Yeah. You knew there was a county sheriff on the other end just waiting, wasn't there? No person shall horse race on said road, nor shoot craps on or alongside said road.
Oh, there you go.
Or any bridge thereof. Actually, anytime you're gambling in a road, either then or now, it's never been a good idea, is it?
Always a gamble.
Absolutely. The driver of any wagon, cart, carriage, sleigh, or other vehicle on said road, when met or overtaken by any other wagon, cart, carriage, sleigh, or other vehicle shall keep to the right so as to allow such other wagon, cart, carriage, or other vehicle meeting or overtaking as aforesaid to pass freely and without obstruction or hindrance. So the right-hand driving, it exerted itself very early on.
The rules that you recognize today are outlined in that document.
And people are not following these rules, and we said that you should back in 1864, so duly noted.
We still don't do it right.
The following are hereby declared the tolls chargeable on said road, to wit, for every sleigh, sled, carriage, or other vehicle drawn by one horse, 2 cents per mile, and for every animal in addition thereto, 0.75 cents per mile, for every horse and rider or lead horse, 1.5 cents per mile, for every score of sheep or swine, 5 cents per mile, for every score of cattle, mules, or asses, 10 cents per mile, for passing the bridge over White River at Indianapolis, the amount chargeable for traveling 4 miles on the road, the width of the said road is 80 feet.
That was a covered bridge at the time.
Yep.
There was a big bridge there, yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is Allen's addition. If his math is right, it would cost a person 8 cents to cross the bridge over White River and 0.75 cents if you brought your ass. But 10 cents, for, 10 cents for a score of asses, which if that holds up, is a score not a dozen dozen? That's a number, that's a large number of asses.
Now, they're not talking about your friends. They're talking in the biblical sense, the biblical sense.
But it also, too, this underscores what these roads were being used for. I mean, people were moving livestock. Yeah. They were moving themselves. And then going back to my earlier point, and I didn't put it in really a good juxtaposition because much of this began in the 1800s. But by the time we got to 1910, if you had an automobile, you wanted to get on down the road. And that's really, it seems like that was probably the kickstart that got America thinking, we've got to have some roads.
I'd say that's true. And it really started with Carl Fisher and his Lincoln Highway, which ironically does not go through Indianapolis, even though Carl Fisher lived here. But that was the first coast-to-coast improved highway. I will not say paved, because it was not paved all the way, although that was the intent. And that was finished, more or less, in 1915.
Allen and I have talked a little bit about Carl Fisher. I'm fascinated by him because he was a road man as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then I'm going to guess with the emergence of Indianapolis as being a fairly large crossroad for rail travel, and I know the canal never came to fruition.
Largest Union Station in the country.
Yep. And there you go.
And the first.
And first,
so therefore, Washington Street became obviously a very important thoroughfare. So I'm going to guess at some indeterminate point, the National Road, while it still has those great stops every 10 to 12 miles, and we can oftentimes see the little tiny, I almost call them cottage-style hotels that cropped up, I'm going to guess we sort of turbocharged the National Road at some point. About what era was that?
The National Road had faltered as a road with the coming of the railroad, and don't forget the interurbans as well, because there was an interurban track all along the National Road too. And we had the most interurban tracks in the nation.
So did we actually run, I know interurban, to call it light rail is somewhat of a misnomer, but
electric.
Were we actually
They're
running
electric.
Our interurban tracks down the National Road?
Down, right straight down the middle. And in fact, when they dig up, they run into the rails, they'll run into the
bridge. Those are the trolley tracks that eventually would hook up to the interurban.
It is amazing now that one of the things that we are, Allen will attest, it took a long time to get here today because traffic in Indianapolis has become problematic in many areas, but that we actually had quite a public transportation system.
I would
system
sure like to see that come back. I come from an area where there is still an interurban.
Well, they're trying.
Have one, the
they're
South
trying.
Shore.
We'll see if it works. Red line and so fingers crossed.
And we've talked about, too, the blue line will be running down Washington Street, the National Road around here.
Yeah.
So, you know, the one thing I did want to talk about is these are all things that we all take for granted, that there's a road that goes anywhere and then a parking lot once you arrive. But for many Americans for quite a long time, moving from Columbus, Ohio to Indianapolis was quite a chore.
Well, Indianapolis didn't really exist, and it was on paper even after that, after it was set up in 1825 and became our state capital because it was smack in the middle of the state. In fact, initial plans for the National Road did not include Indianapolis, but because that was becoming our state capital and because the road hadn't actually gotten here yet, the route was adjusted. But the idea was, in fact, to link the state capital. So the idea of going from Columbus, Ohio to Indianapolis was a concept that really didn't exist. The idea was to go west, period, at first. And really, that's what you saw at first. You saw westward traffic more than any eastward traffic for the first few decades of the road, because people were coming for, as you said, Alan, opportunity.
Well, so, if you saw them going east, it was usually with their tails tucked between their legs because they had failed.
Something had gone wrong.
You got to remember, this is frontier.
And we had amazing westward expansion.
You can't even picture that. This is woods.
Frontier.
Yeah.
You could, there are descriptions that you could walk the entire length going from treetop to treetop. And that's just unimaginable to us today.
Yeah, the forestation and just what was available. And then that's part of the reason, as you said, why not build a plank road? We seem to have plenty of trees, so we'll just slap the planks down. And they only lasted, I'm going to guess, a little while. And
well, it's manifest destiny. It's move. It's head west regardless of the consequences. And you can go out west today and see these little hamlets. I just came from one in Hannibal, Missouri that looks like it's frozen in time. And when you see them, you understand better because it's right on the Mississippi. Well, the National Road was our Mississippi. We did not have a major waterway to speak of here. So the road became our vital link to points west and to points east as well.
What is your favorite thing along the current road as it stands now? Because fast forward, now we're several years ahead. But what is your favorite artifact that remains, or your favorite quaint fun fact about the National Road that still exists today?
I'm kind of holistic about the National Road because that's the beauty of it. You can travel down the road and you are seeing 150 or more, actually more like 175 years of history all before you. Okay, there on your right is an inn that people stayed in the 1830s and 40s. Oh, look, around the corner, here's an old dead motel that was very much in use in the 1950s and so on, but the same use. But there they are, more than 100 years apart in building them. And so on. You just see the whole layers of history are opened up before you as you go along the National Road, because that's a transportation corridor, which is the beauty of a transportation corridor. The road came first, and then when they were starting to build the railroad, where would they build it? Well, of course, along the National Road. Had they ever decided to go ahead with a canal, they would have built a canal there too. There's places in Indiana, for example, along US 24, you have seven different forms of transportation represented in the same corridor. You have a canal, you have the river first, and the road along the river, and a canal, and an interurban right away, and a railroad right away, and the first highway from the 1920s, and then the current highway.
And everything then, absolutely, and then everything
it's enough.
Then was designed to try to get from point A to point B, whether you're moving cargo, or you're moving livestock, or you're trying to move yourself down these roads. And then it's almost like market forces and geography meets Father Time, because as you said, the area that you mentioned is a very lightly populated portion of our state. Yet at one time, there was some thought process to every possible scheme, if you will, of transportation.
Well, when Joe Jarzan and I wrote the two books on the National Road, we divided them into two sections because we always felt that the section from Richmond to Indianapolis was about commerce. It was about selling things. It was about creating things, making things. The section between Indianapolis and Terre Haute is about moving. And if you think about what's there still remaining, Union Station is west of Indianapolis, technically. The interurban stations, the bus stations were west of Indianapolis. The airports were west of Indianapolis. It was about moving. So once you get past west of Indianapolis, everything seems to be about speed and moving. Where is the track? Mm-hmm. Where are the automobile manufacturers? Where are the race car driving places? West of Indianapolis.
West of Indianapolis. And
on the National Road.
Interesting that is either serendipity or just, the collective energy, if you will, move that.
Well, where's Tony Holman from? Terre Haute.
Terre Haute. Mm-hmm. So what is your favorite thing, Alan, that's sort of leftover residual or?
Well, people refer to me as a historian because it's an easy thing to say. I'm not really a historian. I'm more of a pop culturalist. And so everything that I'm interested in revolves around popular culture. And popular culture is as we've talked, Jay, it's a wide net. Yes. So I like the stories from the road. People don't realize that the history goes back as far as the road. And when you think pop culture, you think the Beatles and you think Elvis. It's not that. It's the outlying fingers that bring you back to history. And one of my favorite, if I had to pick, I've got a young man here that if I can talk him into it, I'll have him read it to you. They're Martin Van Buren, everybody's heard that name, he's president. When Van Buren was in office, the road had been neglected for almost a decade. It was getting rutted, it was getting rough, carriages were tipping over, people were falling out. And there was a movement to try and get the government's attention. And Van Buren had other things on his mind. He really wasn't worried about the National Road. But on one of his travels out west, he rode on the road. And he stopped somewhere. Nobody really knows for sure. Plainfield claims him. They have an elementary school there named after him. But nobody really knows exactly where it happened. But he did stop and give a speech, shake some hands. And during that speech, a couple of the local ruffians, we assume they're teenage kids, went out.
The type,
yeah. don't we all? Went out and loosened the lug nuts, so to speak, on his carriage, on his fancy carriage, so that when Van Buren got back in and headed back out on the road, the wheels came off and he came tumbling out. I found in my travels, in a box of nothing, I found a poem that a young lady had written in 1842 about that night. And you got to remember, this is 1842. So women certainly didn't curse. Women certainly didn't do double entendres. But if you listen closely, it mentions Martin Van Buren. And it's a relic from that. That's the kind of things that I like to do. So if I can talk Cameron McAbee, who is Cameron's Warren Central graduate, graduated, 2 years ago?
Yes.
And he was our scholarship kid for the Ghost Tours. So he's now acting at Franklin, Franklin College. So I've asked him to come out here and read this to you. And keep in mind, this is written in 1842, so it's not going to come out as a gut punch laugh, but you might get a giggle.
No, I'm looking forward to it. We'll have him sit where Alan is, and as you said, this was a poem written about the event of that night.
Scenes of the party of June the 5th, 1842. 'Twas on the 5th of June in the afternoon, in full prime for dancing. The girls and boys, without much noise, repaired to Mr. Hutchins' mansion. High in the sky, the clouds did fly. The rain was fast approaching. But heaven's threats and rain that wets was but nothing of a thing of nothing. The gift being done, the sport begun by dancing of a four. But the fiddle string, the cursed thing, it stayed them once or more. To take a share, I did not dare, although quite engaging. But fond of sport of another sort, the idle girls a-glazing. But after a bit, the dancing quit, and the ladies talked of going. Then through the mud, the way they scud, was a sin to Martin Van Buren. 'Twas all in vain for mud and rain to think the way blockaded. And little streams was not but dreams, for through them all they waded. But before I stop, a hint I'll drop. Two lads that are not funny, two parties so, to never go, without 50 cents in money. For to have a chance, some will advance, all in ready money. At least 6 cents at their own expense, although it's rather many. Now, my friend, what I have penned is but a small beginning to tell you all that did befall what set you all a-grinning. Eliza Ann Stokes.
Oh, that's very good. Thank you for doing that.
Thanks for having me.
So what you're saying, Alan, is the Secret Service was not as attentive back then.
Yeah, what I'm saying is I needed to inject some youth into us old couple old guys.
But no, it's an amazing thing that you found this, and you know, it's so funny with these podcasts. You know, we try and make them a set length so that you can actually listen to them at home, but we do want to whet your appetite for just how amazing And I would just call it a venture, the National Road was. And I
still is.
Everyone has a certain thing that they like in history. For me, it's always the formation of any idea, whether you say, let's build the Erie Canal, or let's build the National Road, or let's send a man into outer space as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11's mission. But I just love that these ideas came from a group of individuals, and then it took somebody then to go forth and do all these things. Alan, I know, is a big fan of the vibration of it all, and you can literally stand, we can walk out of this building and stand next to this plank road that obviously is covered in asphalt now. But
not only that, but there are places on this road that if you care to explore, sure. You can go into the culverts and you can see the layers of the road are still there.
Absolutely.
Every single layer from the gravel, well, obviously the dirt, the gravel, the plank, on up to the modern day. And you can't do that anyplace else. I mean, that's touching history, that's seeing history. It makes it a lot more real to you.
There are supposedly a couple of locations, and you guys know far more about this road than I do, but a couple of locations where you can actually see what might have been the original road surface extant, mm-hmm. because the more modern road had bypassed that section.
Well, yeah, there's an original bridge in Louisville, which is
that's
amazing.
Kind of what I'm referring to, is that supposedly that...
In Reelsville, it goes back off the road. You can see the bend of the road. In the Terre Haute section with the bridge is something to see because it's so tiny.
Yeah.
And you can't imagine that being designed for two Model Ts passing each other. But it
barely
was.
Did.
Yeah.
So, Alan, do you have other upcoming projects besides the books about the National Road?
I do. I just got notification waiting for me when I got back. I'm going to write a book on the house where Lincoln died, which I'm ecstatic about that. I just found out about that yesterday. Joe and I are going to do two more books on the National Road. These will be postcard books because of all you've seen them.
Oh,
there's all the postcards.
I have quite a few of them myself.
Yeah, the old motels. Good. I'll be talking to you then. the old motels that are no longer there. And you know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say we grew up with those.
Yes.
That are no more. These little old ranch style green tiled hotel rooms.
Absolutely.
A lot of them are very shabby apartments now.
Yes. And as you said,
They're still there, and if you have the good imagination, you can see them
as
they once were.
I have seen exactly what you talked about, sort of a main office building and then three or four cottage-style homes, and those were the original travel motels.
But I would be, you know, what's important to me is that the Indiana National Road Association, which we both were affiliated with, goes on, and they're still doing good work, and that's important because many of these road associations are no more. They folded because the funding was cut off.
Yeah, they had their goal and achieved a certain status of the road, and then...
Well, sometimes involuntarily. Sometimes they would come in and they were axed. Well, the INRA, which is the Indiana National Road Association, is still going strong. It's funded by the state. It's funded by volunteer funds. We still have a soft spot in our heart for it, obviously. And we are going, as I said... At the Masonic Lodge 666, come out Wednesday, October 16th, and you'll be able to meet the folks that are manning it now. Hopefully, join INRA, and I'm going to bring out more props. I'm going to bring out October and Overington special, so there'll be something ghostly, and I think I'm going to bring out Burger Chef and National Road stuff. So.
Yeah, there's some sensationalism that pertains. You'll find, I'm sure, something.
That works for Irvington.
Absolutely, it does. Irvington, of course, the epicenter of all things. And we even did a show one time as to perhaps explain why Irvington has just 8% more ghostliness than any other portion of central Indiana.
That's right.
And Gloria, any new projects or anything you're working on?
I'm always working on something, right? I've got a couple grant applications going, so somewhat dependent on that. But I'm planning to do, I love the National Road, and I've done the whole length of it more than once. And in fact, was just staying in an old inn in Grantsville, Maryland, perhaps you know it, Ellen, which there's a wonderful old National Road bridge there built in 1811 that is stone, still there. Still could support traffic. It's just not wide enough for today's traffic, but it's a beautiful bridge, and they have preserved it. And there is an old inn there that, oddly, is very cheap to stay in, which is good news, too. So was staying there just last month. But one of my favorite roads is the Lincoln Highway, as I mentioned. I grew up in northern Indiana, as did you, and the Lincoln Highway was at my back door, essentially.
I would love to do a Lincoln Highway
So I'm going to do a Lincoln
podcast.
Highway thing.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Because that's another edition of, in fact...
I'd love to join you on that.
Oh, we would love to have you. And in fact, Alan, we may think about, you did a great presentation for the band, the anniversary of Woodstock, yeah. At the Irving Theater. It might be interesting to do perhaps the founders of the Speedway in maybe mm-hmm. a similar foundation because of what all they accomplished and the fact that they were part of the automotive history.
And several of their houses still stand too.
Yes. And
well, they, you know, in this country, there are three roads that are considered mother roads, and Route 66, obviously, the Lincoln Highway and the National Road. Mm-hmm. And two of those three have strong Hoosier connections.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is interesting that they do, all roads lead back here to Indiana. And that's why we do Firehouse Irvington. We'd like to thank once again Alan E. Hunter, who is, of course, can be read, and is it called the East Side Voice?
I want to make East sure Side, I Weekly View. Properly. Weekly View. It's the old East Side Voice,
okay,
but
the
it's the Weekly
Side
View.
Voice. And
look for the green kiosks.
And you can pick up his regular columns there. And the nice part is you can go back online and read some of your columns, and you've had
yeah,
some
bonus content.
Insight.
Always
yeah, bonus.
Content this qualifies as bonus content.
Absolutely. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the show, and Glory June Grief. So thank you so much for coming. It's a pleasure meeting you. You were the very first radio announcer at a place that I still work, Q95 Radio in
yeah.
Indianapolis.
Those were the days.
So I feel like we have a bridge of history, and you and I actually conversed one Saturday night in 1979. That's the last time we
Ouch.
Talked. So so we're glad to have you back on the show, and it's glad to hear you're still speaking to me.
Yes, I am.
This has been Firehouse Irvington, and we'd like to thank so many of the people, including artists and realtors, who were a huge help to us when we did our broadcast out at the Irvington Farmers Market, which, of course, we'll be doing another broadcast from there not too distant from now. But if you want to live in one of the coolest spots in the world, you definitely want to go to Artisan. They'll definitely craft an outstanding deal for you. You find them right on the National Road.
Strangely enough.
That's the perfect tie-in for today's show. So thank you once again for everyone who helps with Firehouse Irvington, including the amazing Kevin Friedley and Dale Arcus, too. You know, we really, if we don't mention Dale, who absolutely went out of his way to make what was our former broadcast facility open to us, we really appreciate that. So thank you so much, Dale. And Dale, he doesn't know this yet, but he'll be doing a podcast sometime on the Irving Theater, of which he literally lives adjacent to. So it's going to be a pretty amazing story. On behalf of all the people that do this show, we'd like to thank everyone. And until next time, be kind.